Welcome to episode 14 of the VHAA podcast. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. Starting with our industrial roundup and beginning with community health. With regards to community health, there's not much change with regards to the Social and Community Services Agreement, but with respect to the Health and Allied Services Agreement, which expired at the end of December 2015, we've received a log of claims from the Health Workers Union. Members may recall that there was a 64-page booklet that was circulated some time ago by the Health Workers Union. We've now received a log of claims which is 62 pages, but what that log of claims does is set out proposed clauses. So we'll be working through that and examining its contents and providing comment to members and seeking their feedback shortly. With respect to the Allied Health Professionals Agreement, we have had some requests for meetings and we have proposed to meet with them in the last week of April. In some instances, members have received requests for meetings, notwithstanding that they have yet to be served with a log of claims. But we look forward to continuing our discussion with VAPA and also issuing NERRs shortly. We are yet to receive a log of claims for community health for medical scientists, that is, psychologists and dietitians. Turning to the acute sector, thank you to all those members who attended a regional forum over the last few weeks and for interacting and providing such valuable feedback. With regards to the enterprise agreements and VAPA, members will be aware by now that there has been an issue with regards to the NERRs. There were five health services who have issued NERRs that were not compliant. And we are seeking to clarify with the Commission what the options are to resolve that. At worst, it may require a re-ballot, but we are hoping that to test whether that can be avoided. With regards to the other agreements, we're still awaiting a hearing date with regards to mental health, but we have been asked also to collect the NERRs for that. Members should anticipate in future that part of our process will be to ask members to return those NERRs to our office so that we can check for compliance issues well ahead of time. With regards to the HWU and nurses agreements, we are seeking to activate the SDPPWGs, that is the working groups associated with those, so that we can commence those discussions with the relevant unions and with the department to work through some implementation issues. Members should also be aware that our reference groups have continued and have started to prioritise the key implementation issues. This has seen us develop a number of papers, including a draft guideline for family violence to apply the family violence clause, as well as, in the case of the nurses' agreement, a draft guideline with respect to long service leave and casuals. And we hope to progress those, firstly with the reference groups and members, before having discussions with the department and the union. That's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the VHAA Weekly Update, where we take a particular topic and go in depth. Joining me this week for the discussion is Tim Nagle, Principal Industrial Relations Consultant and Feng Shui Devotee. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Stuart. Good to be here.
Tim, by now you know how it works. Could you be kind enough to reveal this week's subject by removing the subject box? And just for the purpose of those who are listening rather than watching this particular broadcast, would you be kind enough to describe what it is you see?
It's Tony Abbott in swimmers.
Tim, you couldn't be more wrong. Take a closer look at that photo and tell me what he's wearing.
Red bathers.
They're certainly red, but they may be bathers, they may not. We couldn't be sure. They could be some other form of undergarment. And what's that person getting out of?
The sea.
It is the sea. So if we break that down into elements, what we have is red, undy, sea. Redundancy. That's today's topic.
Yes. Very good.
For the benefit of those people who are watching, what we might do is just simply turn this to one side so that they're not confronted by the sight of somebody getting out of the ocean for the entirety of our discussion. But today's topic is redundancy. So, Tim, the new round of agreements have redundancy provisions. They are mostly common. For the purposes of today's discussion, we'll be concentrating in particular with respect to the nurses' agreement, but it's worth pointing out that there are some minor and necessary variances between agreements in terms of the redundancy provisions.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the majority of the clauses are exactly the same.
And it's worth pointing out that previous agreements didn't have redundancy provisions within them. And what that meant in a practical sense is that it meant that a lot of key things were then up for discussion and debate in terms of what was a necessary process or an entitlement in the case of a redundancy.
Yeah, we've talked before about the problem with not having clear processes and clear entitlements in the agreement and some of the confusion that creates. So the new agreements certainly do have express provisions as they relate to redundancy and associated entitlements.
So let's go to Clause 12 of the Nurses Agreement, which is the Redundancy and Associated Entitlements Clause. And at 12.2, what we have are a list of definitions. Starting at the top of that list, we have a definition of an affected employee. And there's probably a distinction that people should be aware of as to who is an affected employee for the purpose of the redundancy clause.
So the affected employee is the person whose role has been made excess to requirements. So the actual person who is either being redeployed or made redundant, or the position has been made redundant.
So I think the key thing for me is that an affected employee is someone whose role has been abolished.
Yeah.
That is not the same as saying that the person's employment will be terminated, because the objective with these processes is to consider whether there is an alternative to termination as a result of redundancy.
Yeah, that's right. So this is about trying to preserve the employment where possible.
So with respect to an affected employee, ideally what we want to do is put them into a comparable role. And one of the definitions there is for a comparable role.
Yeah, that's right. So the agreement specifically defines comparable role, and it says that it may be in the same occupation as the affected employee.
Just on that point, Tim, I think it's worth emphasising that in terms of a comparable role, we're talking about the same occupation. So in the case of a registered nurse, we're talking about a comparable role as a registered nurse.
Yeah, that's right.
There are seven elements with respect to a comparable role, and each one of them must be taken into consideration in order to meet that test. So it has to be the same occupation. Then it has to be one of the following three things. That is, the same clinical specialty as the former position, or another specialty where the employee agrees, or a position that with reasonable support as described by the clause, would enable the employee to undertake the position. I think the emphasis there on that element is those three branches have an or between them as opposed to an and.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's to cater for a situation where even though it's the person's in a specialty, with reasonable support they can go into another area or another specialty. And that will turn on the different circumstances. So, for instance, it might be more challenging for someone to go from an aged care ward to an ICU ward, less challenging for someone to go from a surgical ward to a medical ward, for instance.
So the third element with regards to comparable role talks about it being at the same grade. Now, that doesn't mean that parties can't discuss an opportunity at a lower grade. It just means it may not be a comparable role.
Yeah, that's right. So, and look, that will turn on the circumstances. It may be that an individual wants to stay within the same organisation, but there's no, say, grade three roles particularly available. So they will consider a grade two. Now, that doesn't mean that the clause doesn't operate to preclude that from happening if the parties want to.
Just it's worth emphasising that in terms of the effect of a comparable role, if an employee turns down a comparable role, they may not have an entitlement to severance pay.
Yeah, that's why it's important.
But if a person accepts a role that's not comparable, that doesn't give them an entitlement to redundancy. There are other entitlements that kick in under those circumstances.
That's right.
And in terms of the fourth element, in terms of comparable role, it takes into account the ordinary hours that the employee ordinarily worked. And the fifth element talks about a reasonable distance from where they had previously been located. And once again, the term reasonable distance is capitalised. And the significance of the capital letters there.
So it's a defined term if it's capitalised.
So if you see reasonable distance with a capital R and a capital D, you'll know that term is elsewhere defined, and you should have a look at that definition to understand what it's intended to mean. Item six is taking into account the affected employee's personal circumstances and family responsibilities. I think that's probably a statement of the obvious. And also taking into account health and safety considerations, which is really about that all-round consideration as to the circumstances as to whether a role can be considered comparable or not.
Yeah, that's right.
And the definitions also clause also refers back to consultation and flicks back to the consultation clause, which we discussed in our previous podcast, that you need to go through the consultation clause where you're engaging in organisational change that might result in redundancy.
Yeah, so this isn't about revisiting what the changes are. This is about how to mitigate against the effects of that change on the individual employee and how to support them through the implications of that change process.
Now, I know we're dwelling a bit on the definitions, but it's important to get those mechanics right in order to understand the clause. There is a definition for reasonable distance, which doesn't actually set a number of kilometres in terms of what a reasonable distance is. Is there a particular reason for that?
No, I think the different circumstances will take in different considerations. So, you know, where there is for instance, a metropolitan context with lots of transport and public transport, that might be different to where someone doesn't have a car or doesn't have a licence in a rural area, for instance. So I think it really, the reasonable distance does depend on the situation.
I think for me, one of the benefits of having criteria and having that description is there becomes a basis to resolve a dispute in the event that one arises.
Mm.
And it gives effectively the commission something to work with if it needs to.
Yeah, that's right. And it can't prescribe every situation. So whilst, you know, we've talked a lot about the benefits of a process, this is really that procedural elements, but there still needs to be regard given to the individual circumstances.
And look, the last definition I'd like to focus on is the redeployment and a definition of a redeployment period of 13 weeks. It was common that a lot of hospitals did have a redeployment period, but there was a lack of uniformity and it meant that it could be a source of disputation. But by prescribing it and defining it should mean that there isn't that disputation in future.
No, and if everyone knows what the period is, then people can use that to their advantage to try and make sure that all the options are considered and people have the certainty around that.
So if we move to clause 12.3, which is headed redeployment, and that really links back to the fact that the primary objective before making someone redundant is to consider whether there are alternatives and to consider whether a person can be redeployed. Really, termination from redundancy should be a matter of last resort.
Mm.
So that first sub-clause there, it talks about an employee being required to be advised of certain things in writing. Just in terms of those that requirement and what those items are.
So so the date the affected employee's role is to be redundant, the details of what the redeployment process are going to be, so the contact people and how that's going to operate, what the reasonable support that will be provided in accordance with the requirements, the sub-clauses underneath, and also the affected employee's rights and obligations. So it's really setting out, I mean, it's an important document in terms of that document, in that it really sets out the process for the employee about what's going to happen next. We know that most people in this situation are probably going to be in a more fragile state than they would be. I know that uncertainty of employment is a significant thing for people with responsibilities and accountabilities outside work. So this is really the opportunity for the employee to set out for the employee what's going to happen.
So it's really about making that process transparent.
Yes.
And describing and writing the things that are going to occur. The clause then goes on to set out some obligations that apply to the employer. Talks about making every effort to redeploy someone to a comparable role and taking into account their personal circumstances.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it should be obvious, but it's good to have these things expressly included in the provision.
The other thing that should be obvious is the role of the employee under their circumstance and the obligation of the employee.
I mean, it is the party's responsibilities, this whole process. So as such, both parties have got obligations that they need to meet to make sure that the opportunity to be redeployed is maximised. So in terms of the employee obligations, to identify appropriate training needs where that's relevant, developing a resume or CV to assist in securing the redeployment, and also actively monitoring and exploring appropriate redeployment opportunities.
It's that requirement that they must actively participate in that process, which I think is most useful to express in the agreement.
And I think that can cause problems where people, for whatever reason, don't want to be redeployed. There is a requirement to be actively involved in that process.
The following subclause sets out the potential consequence for rejecting a comparable role, which is why that definition, I guess, we talked about earlier is so important.
Yeah, so, I mean, the upshot of this clause is that they may not receive a redundancy payment if they do reject a comparable role. So it's important that people realise that, and I think that gives more weight to people giving proper consideration to the process and proposed roles during that process.
It supports better decision-making.
It does.
But our members will note the use of the term may. That is, it's not certain to have that impact, but it could.
So there's a process under the Fair Work Act for the Commission to consider reducing redundancy payments.
I think probably the key thing with the term may is it depends on all the circumstances, and we can't possibly turn our mind to every single scenario that might arise.
No.
And that's the reason for talking about may. There's also a provision during that redeployment period, that 13-week period, that an employer is entitled to utilise someone during that time.
Yeah, so I think it's important that that time isn't a wasted period of time. I mean, the employee can still be allocated temporary duties. And, you know, for a nursing, a large nursing organisation, there will be nursing work required to be done during that period. And so they can still be utilised through that process.
And the other part of that obligation, we talked about that definition of comparable role, but it also comes with a requirement for support, and under redeployment it does set out what some of those support requirements are.
Yeah, and it does. It's quite express in terms of what that looks like. So that may include theory training relevant to the clinical area or environment, and that would happen as a matter of course, but it sets that out. Also, a defined period of up to 12 weeks in which the affected employee works in a supernumerary capacity, for instance. And that will depend on the circumstances, so there might be a longer period for some circumstances and less period for others. In addition to that, it also has support for educational staff in the clinical environment, and also a review at 12 weeks, for instance, to see how that transition or how the support process is going.
And just in terms of that redeployment period of 13 weeks, so we've talked about the obligations on the parties and the fact that certain support must be provided, but sometimes despite the best will of the parties, both parties realise that redeployment opportunities are unlikely to arise.
Yeah, and this is probably more likely to happen in those in the higher classifications, but there may be circumstances where everyone realises that there's no other grade sixes or grade five roles or whatever it may be, and that the pays are unlikely or don't want to pursue lower classification redeployments. So there is capacity within the clause for those in those circumstances to pay out the period of 13 weeks, for instance.
So you don't have to have somebody shackled to their desk for 13 weeks. The parties can agree to pay out that period in addition to any severance payment.
That's right. And I think it would become relatively clear to all the parties very early in the process, whether that was likely or not.
And I think it's worth emphasising that it might be part of the period. It might be that after a period of time, the parties realise that a redeployment option or a comparable role is unlikely.
That's right.
And the redeployment provision also emphasises the fact an employee can agree to be redeployed to a non-comparable role.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. This isn't about limiting opportunities for people to stay within organisations where there isn't a comparable role, because that might suit particular people, particularly in areas where there's not many health services, for instance, where really employment with that same health services is the only option.
So in terms of, just to summarise with regards to redeployment, we have a redeployment period, we have some procedural requirements on the employer and some obligations on the employer. The employee also has certain obligations. If an employee rejects a comparable role, they may not have severance payments. There's a requirement for support, but the parties do have some flexibility if a comparable role or redeployment opportunity is unlikely.
Exactly.
In terms of the next subclause, it talks about the support for affected employees. So it actually spells that out rather than simply leaving it to the imagination.
Yeah, look, I mean, for those people who have had experience in this area, there are a range of support mechanisms that are frequently used. So they're listed in the clause. So they would be counselling and support services. Most people have an EAP sort of process that addresses those concerns. Retraining, particularly where there's a movement across specialties, and we talked about the clinical support before. Preparation of job applications. So how they may prepare those. Interview coaching, time off to attend job interviews has been a common theme in redundancy provisions for a very long time. And also funding of independent financial advice for employees eligible to receive a separation package as well. And that's really about how to try and maximise the benefit for those, because these people may be not stepping into another role in the immediate future. So to help them with their financial security, it's also an option available.
Just in terms of those, I mean, I think it's worth emphasising that that list is not an exhaustive list. Mm. It's an indicative list and it applies where relevant. And what's relevant to one employee may not be relevant to another.
Exactly, that's right.
Moving on to salary maintenance in the event that somebody moves to a position which results in a reduction in pay. So it does prescribe a salary maintenance period of 52 weeks. By prescribing a salary maintenance period, it prevents that being a subject of dispute. But just in terms of that process, I guess, of red circling personal leave as opposed to annual leave and long service leave, and the different approach that's taken to those two items.
Yeah, so the clause preserves the value of the long service leave and annual leave. And it does that to ensure that there's no disincentive for people staying in particular at lower classifications. So those money values are preserved, but not the sick leave. So sick leave is a variable entitlement they may or may not use. That would change the lower classification. But if the lower classification is something that's by the parties agreed to, then it would be the long service leave and the annual leave value would be preserved.
And in terms of one of the items that can come up during restructure is a relocation. That is, an employee may be asked to relocate from where they usually work to a new work location. The clause also sets out some entitlements with respect to that, some process as well as an allowance.
Yeah, that's right. So in addition to the reasonable distance provision, the agreement also acknowledges that employees may incur additional costs from that relocation process. So there's a process for considering those costs, and up to a maximum of $1,900 reimburse the employee for those additional costs.
So just to emphasise, there's a cap.
That's right.
And the clause then goes on to set out that if a person is terminated as a result of redundancy, then it's the Victorian State Government Industrial Relations Redundancy Policy that applies. But there is an additional provision which I think members should be aware of, where an employer facilitates employment with another employer within the public health sector.
Yeah, so this is about not limiting the opportunities of the parties to find that alternative employment. So it actually encourages the parties to look beyond their walls, so to speak, and to other employers as well.
So I think this is a real encouragement for employees if they are in the unfortunate position of having to consider termination as a result of redundancy, is to check with other employers as to whether or not they have any suitable vacancies, because that might, A, keep that person within the public health system, which we of course want to do, but it also may mean that person gets to keep their accruals. There isn't a requirement to pay severance.
That's right. And the reality is that if someone is made redundant, then they're going to look in those neighbouring organisations anyway. So this clause is about facilitating that process.
Tim, we know that that redundancy issues only come up from time to time, hopefully, and we know that they're always difficult. So I think in terms of the advice, we would ask members to contact us.
Yes, that's right, if they had any trouble or needed any advice.
Well, thank you, Tim, for taking us through the redundancy provision of the nurses agreement. People should check individual agreements for some of those variances, particularly some of the details do vary a little bit. They should pay attention to that. But thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Stuart.
And thank you, Tony.